Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Bob Galen, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, John Coleman. Nice to meet you, and thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Delighted to speak with you today about your book, Extraordinary Badass Agile Coaching. Got the book here, and for the people who are watching online, but for the audio people, it's got a nice clean cover, and there's a circle in the front says transforming, facilitating in one kind of corner of the circle, and then guiding, learning, agile, lean, and then coaching and leading and serving and advising and the other. And it's a lovely book. It's a nice deep book. There's 340 odd pages in the book, plus some glossary stuff. Nice read. I read it in about 2 hours. But if you know your stuff, you can read it in 2 hours. But if you don't, you know, if you need to be educated, it might take you, you know, a bit longer. But it's a really, really nice book. And looking forward to chatting with you about the book today, Bob.
Me too. Thank you, John. And thank you for reading it. I can't tell you how many times people talk about it, and they've done a cursory view. So you've actually read it. So
absolutely,
I hope I can remember enough of the book to answer your questions. That's always a danger. So, but no, we're good.
And this funny isn't about writing as well, that when you write something a year later, you might say something different.
I'm already thinking about things that I should have amplified more.
Yeah,
So there's things that I could have said differently. Yeah. More importantly, what I think about is I didn't amplify this enough. And I should have. Ethics, for example, is something that I regret. I really wanted to put an entire chapter in. I had invited someone to write it because I was trying to invite other authors, and he got too busy. So ethics is covered, but not as deeply as I would have preferred. And there's other topics I wish I would, if I could go back, I would make some changes.
Yeah, it just reminds me that you thought your book title was a bit cheeky, but there's another book called The No Asshole Rule. Have you read it?
I have it in my bookshelf. Actually, and I just did a podcast with a friend of mine. So we our last podcast we recorded on the Metacast, we have a two-part episode on leading assholes. and we referenced the no asshole rule in the first one, and we'll probably reference it tomorrow when we record the second episode.
Yeah, I wrote to the author and I said, is it okay if I include it? Because he had, you could be a temporary asshole or you can be a certified asshole. And he had a definition and everything. That was hilarious. And I read it to people. But apparently his regrets about the wording. And so in my book that's going to come out soon, the new wording's going to be in there with his permission. But so, I think we're all updating our ideas as we go along. I guess that's the way it should be, right? We're learning and we're realizing that things could be better, right?
I think so. Years ago, I was impressed by Mike Cohn, and other people have done that. But Mike talked about he disagreed with his earlier self, his younger self, and he was writing about not strongly disagreed, but had some disagreements and changes, and that struck me as being very healthy. I would hope that we would reevaluate our positions as we moved forward and learned more.
As we learn things, we decide what to do next.
Exactly.
So, Bob, you are an agile coach. You're an extraordinarily badass agile coach. And I'd love to know how you got into agile coaching in the first place. What sucked you into this world?
You know, it's funny that you asked that because I recently had a series that I was writing of blog posts on professional coaching versus agile coaching, not versus, but contrasting them. And right before that, I wrote my coaching journey because I was thinking about how people got into agile coaching. And my thoughts were there were two paths that I've seen. There's my path and then another path. My path was I was a software developer, and then I was promoted to a leadership role. And then I started leading larger and larger teams, and I moved around, and I had some reasonable success doing that. And I had testing experience, so development experience, testing experience, project management experience. I really was managing a lot of roles over time, and I started coaching. So I didn't aspire to become an agile coach. I was aspiring to become an effective leader, and I was just aspiring to deliver stuff that had value. And I was doing that. And then over time, I got more and more interested in, agile consulting, agile coaching, et cetera. So the way I think of it is I was experience driven coaching. I came in from technology or domain experience, and some agile coaches come that way. There's another path that I observe nowadays where people come into coaching from non-technology or from lightweight technology, where they're chasing, I hate to say it this way, but I think they're chasing the dollars a little bit and trying to get into agile coaching. And one of the problems with that path, they do bring value, soft skills, maybe facilitation skills, but they don't have domain experience, and it's a real problem for them, for example, to provide advice to clients and things like that, because they don't have that grounding. So I came in on the experiential curve, but I wanted to identify, I think there are these two generic curves where people come into agile coaching. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I do think mine makes me a better coach because I have the ability to meet clients more where they are with experience and stories and things like that, as opposed to just asking questions, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And something I talk to people about as well is a really important quality when you start as a change agent is attaining credibility.
Yeah.
Like, who's going to listen to someone they don't respect or, or don't think that's credible? You know, like, if you don't understand what they're working on.
Correct.
You know what I mean? Like, it could be the business domain, could be the technical domain. I remember I was working in an oil company years ago, and the guys and gals, they asked me, they said, you don't have a clue what we're doing, do you? I said, I don't. Honestly, I don't. So I'm going to go onto Wikipedia, and I'm going to go onto YouTube, and I'm going to learn about drilling through rocks under the sea and all that kind of stuff. And but would you mind teaching me like for 45 minutes a week? And because I could do a 3-year oil degree. It was only a 6-month contract. You know, the math doesn't work. But it really went down very well. And actually, within a few months, actually, I was realizing that toolbox of 10 tools that I had, maybe, that I was thinking about, maybe only one or two of them were valid, actually, for that situation. Reminds me of an Italian guy who said to me one day, do you know the way sometimes as change agents we think people are making up a wall, there's a fake wall, they're just putting up a wall just to kind of, get in the way and just be annoying and so on. But actually, sometimes there really is a wall there.
Yeah.
If we understood the domain, we'd know that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I do think in general in Agile, and it's not just coaching, I mean trainers. So I've never been a trainer, but I know a lot of Scrum Alliance trainers, for example. And I think there's a large percentage of them that are teaching things that they've never done.
Yeah.
And that's okay. They probably are well-intentioned, most of them, and they're they're running okay courses.
Yeah.
But I wish that practitioner level was higher. Right.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
And if you're going to enter that, like you said, John, then be curious, realize that you have a gap. and then work your butt off a little bit to fill that gap, as opposed to just saying I don't know and then not adding value from the.
And it'd be the same for any kind of changes. If you were a product manager, you'd be expected to learn about the customers, the product, what's going
on. Exactly.
Really deep for 4 months, maybe however long it takes actually to get to understand.
Yep.
So you're an extraordinary badass agile coach, Bob, but you need to explain to us what you meant by that word in the book, badass.
So I am not claiming to be a badass. That's for other people to judge. And some of my clients would emphasize the bad. Some of them might emphasize the ass. So it just depends on who you talk to, John. What I meant was I was really looking for, I saw at the time. So for me to write a book, I have to see a problem. Not that I'm going to solve it, but I wrote a product ownership book years ago. It's in its third edition. And the reason I started it, because there was no guidance at the time. It was around 2008 or 2009. Mm. And there was very little guidance on the product owner role at the time. Mm. And I was like, we need to do something about this. And I think agile coaching was the same inspiration. There's a lot of agile coaching, but there was really clarity. Now, Lisa Atkins and Michael Spade wrote a nice, or Lisa wrote a nice book, and that has a niche, but it was 10 or 12 years ago. And I thought it was time for a bit of an upgrade. So for me, the badass is part attitude, part well-rounded skills. One of the anchors, as you were talking about the cover, the graphic on the cover is really a graphic of the Agile Coaching Growth Wheel, which is a metaphor or a model that I tried to anchor the book on, one of them. And it's really well-rounded. I like the metaphor because it's a wheel, and it has a bunch of stances or competencies. And because I was seeing a lot of Agile coaches who were one-trick ponies, if you will, they had one way of coaching. A lot of it was professional coaching, and we can explore that later. And that's not good enough. So I wanted badasses to, the attributes are become well-rounded. Another attribute is understand that it's an inside-out job. So self-mastery, self-awareness, continuous learning, challenging yourself, walking your talk is really important as a coach, that your role model matters. There's so many coaches that they coach, but they're actually coaching others, but they're not walking their talk. And that matters. So that's part of badassery as well. So there's attributes like that to boldly go in to serve the client and to challenge yourself and then to challenge your clients. And to get out of what I was seeing as a one stance or a one competency mode largely for many coaches and scrum masters, which was maybe facilitation and professional coaching. I was seeing too much lineage into those stances, and I wanted more well-roundedness.
Yeah, me too, Bob. Let's dig into that a little bit, because I remember I joined a bank one day as a contractor, as some kind of an agile coach. I can't remember exactly what the title was. But I remember going through the electronic gates, and my boss, who was like the lead coach, he asked me what I thought was a really weird question. As I was trying to concentrate going through the gates without, you know, kind of hurting myself going through the gate, you know, because they close very fast and so on. It was
right.
Like, it was very strange. And I had a feeling that he was using some technique on me, that so I just metaphorically pulled the shutters down and just didn't let any signals. And then 6 weeks later, he admitted to me that he was a neuro-linguistic programming, master neuro-linguistic programming coach. And there's some very good people doing that, by the way. But he put me off these types of coaches for many years. I had a bias against it. I'm recovered from it now. But because he admitted to me that he felt that motivation and influence are two sides of the same coin. And I wasn't thinking nice words in the back of my head. And they're not probably as nice as the word badass that you have, you know. If you know what I mean.
Exactly.
I was thinking, you know, he was basically trying to hack me without any coaching agreement. And you do talk about coaching agreements are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, having it, you know, because I've experienced that where other people as well have tried to coach me without permission as well. I mean, some people say coaching is a leadership style, but I'm not sure I agree with it entirely, because I think people need to want to be coached. And the biggest worrying development that I've seen in the last few years in agile coaching is the rise of coaching badges, professional coaching badges. Nothing wrong with that. It's good to be professionally skilled in these things. But the problem is that to get one of these badges, you have to clock up so many coaching hours. You know, I don't know, ACF is at 100 hours or something, 500 hours for the next one. I can't remember the letters, you know, PCC, MCC, I can't remember that. But basically, you have to clock up hours. So surprise, surprise, Bob, you know, guess what stance people are going to use when they're going to meet me? You know, if you got this coaching wheel, which one are they going to pick if they want to clock up another coaching hour? You know what I mean?
Right.
So, Bob, how's your world going to change if I remove this impediment? You know, all these kind of questions.
Exactly. It's not just, I mean, it's that, John. I mean, it's the certification. So I'm not going to pick on anything, but I'll talk about IC Agile, for example. Yeah. A lot of the certifications or the training emphasizes that we're doing. So it has Agile coaching as a title. Pre-Agile Coaching Growth, where there was something called the Agile Coaching Competency Framework, or the X-Wing model.
Yeah, that's right.
And it had multiple competencies, mentoring, training, facilitation, professional coaching.
Yeah.
But But the emphasis of the trainers was on professional coaching. Yeah. I think because it's something you can anchor on, it's something you can measure. You can you can actually evaluate whether someone can have a professional coaching conversation. So what's happened is the world of agile coaching has leans very heavily into professional coaching stance, not just by choice by the individuals, but by training or by modeling, et cetera. And that was one of the things I wanted to battle against with the book a little bit. I'm not anti. So some people challenge me that you're anti professional coaching, and I'm really not. I'm not, but I'm pro
coaching in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm pro well-rounded coaching.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
Exactly. It's just about over-indexing, overplaying your cards. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's another thing as well that I've noticed, that most clients that I've come across, when they're asking for my help, they need my help. So they're, you know, sometimes they need advice, actually. Sometimes they actually want to know what to do, and people keep on asking them questions, and they're like almost desperate for advice. And it's like, you know, how long do they have to starve or run out of drinks before they get the advice they're looking for? So it's kind of, it's situational, isn't it? It's about sometimes advising, sometimes mentoring, sometimes teaching.
Right.
I often talk to people about that.
But one of the things is, if you talk to a professional, an ICF-based professional coach, or you go to a training program, you are told not to provide advice, right? You're there to serve the client, and the client needs to figure out their own solutions. And I get that. But there are situations in an agile context where, what if they don't have that? Then I think we have a responsibility and service to our coaching client to switch into an advisory stance. But a lot of these folks who've over-indexed won't do that. In fact, what I find is they look at that as bad or illegal. It's like, I can't do that, right? We can't do that. That's not coaching. And I'm like, no, you're not serving your client in that. And if you have the experience, now some of them don't have the chops to provide that advice. And that's a dilemma, right? That's a problem. But some of them do, and they avoid that. So that's why I anchored on the wheel, is it amplifies. There's two stances in the wheel, or competencies that are new, if you will, from my point of view. One is leading and the other is advising. And I think they were necessary. They were missing. And I think they're important.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes people, and you talked about different types of leading as well. You pulled in some coactive leadership styles, if you like. I think you had purpose-driven. And then you had basically, remind me, Bob, what they were, but they're not coming to
the... Well, the coactive was nice, John, because you can say, here's a leadership stance as a coach, but I like the model of leading from where. So there's positional awareness. So leading as a coach occasionally, and this is one of those things where ICF coaches, their heads will explode. I'm like, you can lead as a coach from the front. No, I can't lead from the front, right? So you can lead as a change agent. You can lead as an influencer. Not a lot, but you can do that. Or you can lead from behind, or you can lead from the sides. Yeah. And I think that model is very useful to think about, what position am I? Not just I'm coach as leader, but coach as leader where? Where am I?
I mean, I do get the professional coaching thing, where the basic idea is that you have the wherewithal, you have the intellect, you've got the skills. You know, if we kind of draw the answers out or the solution, you'll own it more, you'd be more committed to it, and that's all good. But a lot of the time, the people in front of me don't have that wherewithal. And so sometimes I might have to say, I'm not reflecting on their intelligence. There might be some gap in their knowledge or something like that, or skills. And I might have to say, well, I'm aware of another option. Is it okay if I go into a teaching moment for 10 minutes? Would you be okay with that? And then we respect whatever they decide, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I observed, again, one of the drivers for the book, and I'm not trying to make it all about the book, John, but one of my drivers for it is I was seeing so many coaches, And they were operating in what I call death by a thousand questions mode, where, I mean, the client was sweating, like, please help me. What do you think? What's your last experience? What might not work for you? Is there anything else? And the poor person is like almost crumbling. It's like, I'm paying you and you keep asking me questions. Now, I joke about it, but it's not a joking matter. From the client's point of view, it's painful. And very often those coaches get fired. I mean, they're not providing value. So what's, you know, my children can ask me questions. So you're not really providing the value here.
It's really good. Thank you so much for that. So if we go to the coaching arc, that was the next thing that I noticed in your book, Bob, because I think you kind of brought the metaphor in from chess, like the opening moves, the middle, and then the kind of the
end game.
End game. Sorry. Yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that, Bob? And you had loads of examples in the book. I really like that you had different scenarios. I think a lot of people would be able to relate to, quite honestly, because the scenarios look very familiar to me. Can you kind of give us maybe one or two examples of the coaching arc and maybe what's needed to support it as well, like coaching agreements, things like that?
Well, I mean, it's not just the arc. So I didn't create it. Lisa talked about a coaching arc and other coaching programs talk about it. I just gave it maybe different nomenclature. Yeah. But the point is there's this beginning, middle, and end to a coaching conversation. And I think as a coach, one of the things that I talk about is pre-planning your arc or your coaching conversation and then having a reflection. So the arc actually has a pre-beginning, which is thinking about your client. Have we established the agenda? Have we established goals for this coaching? If we haven't, then we need to do that. And then post the ending of the coaching arc, as a coach, I think you want to reflect on your effectiveness. What would you have changed? Did you use the right stance? And then I think within the arc, like, for example, applying stances to the arc is useful. So I was just picking on professional coaching stance, but I think professional coaching stance is a wonderful sandwich in the arc. Entering the arc, asking some questions is a beautiful way to enter. There's nothing wrong with that's just not stay there forever. Asking a few questions, you're sort of sensing and responding.
Yeah.
And then closing the arc on confirming outcomes with questions, professional coaching stance, talking about next steps, talking about accountability, things like that. It's a beautiful way to end it. I think in the middle, that's the place where I think of dancing with your client. A metaphor that I like in the arc is dancing in different stances with your client, sensing and that Kenevan view of sense and respond as a coach. And again, let's not be a one-trick pony. So I may sense a different need. The client needs training, but I'm going to stay in professional coaching because that's the way I've been trained. No, I need to move to mentoring or to training or your point, advising. So that to me is largely in the middle game. And you're deciding. Now you might pre-plan, hey, for this client and this agenda, I may want to think about, I need to enter with what mentoring in the middle game. But you need to be aware, self-aware, and sensing your client, you may need to change that. I guess what I'm trying to say, John, is that there's a lot of ad hoc coaching where people just come in and coach. And I'm a PMP, and I don't know if I want to admit that, but I think there's something good about planning structure, thinking about things in advance, not getting stuck in your plans, but having a game plan. And the arc is, I think, a good metaphor for that. And then thinking about, hey, if that doesn't work, am I prepared to provide advice? Or I need to be prepared. And what would that advice be? Would it be a story? Would it be providing some options to the client, et cetera?
Yeah, I also saw in the book that you had a section on experiments. I was really happy to see that in there. And because sometimes people talk about going from A to B, and there are sometimes it can be useful to have some kind of an idea about where you might want to go. But it's you can use it as a direction, I guess, but you don't know where you're going to end up, quite honestly. So you kind of start with some experiments, don't you, to see what happens, right?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things with experiment, I think as a coach, there was something that I emphasized in the book a little bit called meta skills. Yes. And so I was emphasizing experiments, but I also think the mindset that you have as a coach that you enter with your client, what's going on up here matters. So one of my mindsets is playfulness that actually gets, I get a lot of traction in my coaching about putting on a playful sort of meta skill. And what I'm trying to do is, and the playfulness is experimentation. The playfulness is for me not to get stuck on myself. Mm-hmm. The playfulness is with the client. Do you think this would work? And I might propose a really weird story and they're, oh, that'll never work. Oh, great. Let's talk about other things. Or can we run some experiment that might be close to that? What do you think? So yeah. I think playfulness, curiosity is another meta skill that can be very useful, et cetera. So I think experimentation, but also playfulness. We can take coaching too seriously. You know, we were talking about something that I thought about after the book. One of the things I've been thinking about, and this is like, I think the arc is too rigorous. Sometimes, like I see a lot of, and I may have over amplified it, and coaches are like, I need to get into the middle game, right? I've been here 10 minutes and damn it, I'm not in the middle game yet. It's bad. Or I've spent too much time here.
Yeah.
It's too structured. I mean, it's very valuable.
And
one of the things I regret is I should have just talked about creating a relationship with your client and having a conversation that's natural. Targeted towards an outcome. The arc above the arc is just have a human being to human being conversation around shared outcomes. And I think I missed that.
Yeah, but what I did like is you talked about the, I think you called it the post-arc reflection, where you kind of went into kind of almost like a chill. It's kind of building rapport, relationship building, you know, what are you doing for the weekend, things like that, or how did that go for you? You might even do a retrospective on the arc even. But that was really nice. But you did talk about shuhari, to be fair. So like in martial arts, you start with the rules, don't you? You kind of do the kata. And I'm not a martial arts guy, but that's what they, you know, everyone kind of talks about this. And then they kind of find their own way, don't they?
You're right. The arc is useful for a shu coach.
Exactly.
And I think as you move to ha and ri, you want to be letting go of it. It's just a structure. And it's really then having just a normalized conversation.
Yeah. But it's a good reminder, though, even for really expert coaches, a good reminder for them about the basics, I think, because sometimes we forget, you know, we get pickled, we stay with our clients for too long, you know,
absolutely,
for 3 years and things like that, and nothing, you know, some organization. This one, something I want to talk to you about next is about accountability for the change, because what I write about is, where you got these organizations they implement agility within departments or functions. And so the marketing department is agile here and then this department is that way. But there's just cues between all the departments because the value is cutting across them. But then 3 years later, because the coaches get pickled, they're still overseeing on their watch agility within functions. So all they've done actually is just made each function more efficient, which isn't really effectiveness is really what we're striving for first, right? And it's that kind of gets forgotten by a lot of people. So I think it's no harm actually to remind people of the basics sometimes.
I would agree. Now back to what you were saying, I think something that I didn't talk maybe enough about in the book. This sounds like I'm picking on the book. It's still badass, everyone. But systemic coaching, I think back to your point, we can stay focused in a silo or focused in a function or even focused at a team. I think every coach should be looking at who am I coaching, my client, but also be thinking systemically.
Yeah.
Because in order to meet a client's agenda, you may be coaching the wrong person. Let me use a scrum team example, right?
Yeah.
A scrum master has coaching skills and they're coaching their team, but there's a systemic problem that's driving too much work into the team.
Yeah.
So the scrum master can coach the bejeepers out of the team. But they really need to be looking more systemically or more globally. If they want to improve the effectiveness of their team, they may need to step up. Now, there may be inhibitors to that. It may be out of their job description. It may be out of their skill set. It may be out of their time allocation or whatever. It may be just scary. It may not be safe to do that. But nonetheless, I think all coaches should be, you look at your client, but you also look, I look at my client, but I look at the system. And I try to become more systemic aware.
And to be fair, the ORSC work body manager, that's quite good in that regard. I received a bit of training. You talked about that in the book as well.
Right.
So, yeah, glad to hear you might delve into that more in the future.
I mean, ORSC changed my life, so we can go there or
let's go there.
So ORSC is a professional coaching. So there's sort of the way I think of it, there's two professional coaching organizations or views or strategies. One is systems, and systems are two or more people. And then there's coactive coaching, which is more one-on-one coaching, leadership coaching or individual or, you know, personal coaching, et cetera, professional coaching, journey coaching. I was very interested. I was doing a lot of organizational coaching anyway. And I realized that professional coaching was my weakest stance. So I'm really strong with leading and advising, and I'm really strong with agile lean. So there's, and transformation and change agency. So I have some strengths based on my history, but I was like, darn it, I don't understand this professional coaching as much as I should, to make some educated decisions about how to apply it and where and when. So I was looking at some training. So I opted for ORSC because it aligned with the type of coaching I did. I went through, they have a five class series.
Yeah.
I think, John, you said you took the first one. There's five training sessions. And then I opted into their certification program, which is like an 8-month cohort where you work together. I did not get my certification at the end. It was over COVID and I couldn't get my hours. Unfortunately, and I can go back and get my hours, but I've just been lazy about it.
Yeah,
but I went through 90% of ORSC, and it really changed. It changed the way I look at clients. It helped me systemically. Whenever I'm coaching anyone in an organization, I'm not just coaching them. I'm thinking about what's around them. So, for example, if there's a coaching dilemma or a problem or a challenge I want to, I not only think about the client, I think about who they report to. I think about their ecosystem, their culture. Yeah. Is there something that I should be looking at or coaching there? And what ORSC brings is a lot of system-based tools, not a lot, but a nice set of tools that you can use to reveal systems to themselves. So one of the premises of ORSC is you can't change the system. Just like you can't change an individual if you're coaching them.
Yeah.
That mindset is valuable from professional coaching. I cannot change you. You need to change yourself. But I can do a lot as a coach to show you the change, to reveal you, the system to itself. And ORSC really helped me, give me a tool set and a language for that.
I'm curious, is that what got you started with the pair coaching? Because I noticed you talk about pair coaching in the book. Was it ORSC that got you into that, or were you doing that already anyway?
No, I was just, I was lucky that I was co-coaching, or when I would do multiple coach engagements, there were people there that I just enjoyed working with.
Yeah.
And so we started, the other important part is the clients are okay with paying for it that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you need the dynamics to be supportive of it.
Yeah.
And what I found is it was an experiment, and I found that it created better coaching outcomes. And so right today, if I can pair, I would prefer to pair present. It's not just coaching. If I'm doing conference presentations, I prefer pairing. If I'm doing coaching, I prefer pairing if I can finesse it.
That's very good. Yeah, because
and it's not just my desire. I think the outcomes are better. The reflections are better. The arcs are better. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw really good feedback you got from your prayer coach and from the various scenarios in the book. So you're not just showing theory in the book, you're showing practical examples.
We tried to do that.
Yeah, it was really good. I wanted to ask you about accountability for the change, right? So you talk about the system. And so often, a couple of things I want to mention, actually. So you got internal versus external coach. You talked about that in the book. An internal coach will have more skin in the game. I agree with that. I think that's fair. What happens sometimes, though, is you get pickled or you're pegged into a level in the org or you're kind of, for whatever silly reason, you're perceived as a certain level and someone who has an ego might think you're not worth talking to, or I don't know. I even had a case before Christmas where a guy brought me in to do a Kanban simulation for his team, a team of teams. And he'd been talking to these people for a long while about this and not making much progress. And then 2 hours with me, I could have been anybody, could have been you, could have been, you know, someone who knew with our stuff, basically. And it was like, wow, if they thought they got a slap in the face. I mean, we were having fun, the playfulness, as you talked about, you know, cracking jokes and things like that. But they really, they heard it from an external coach. So sometimes there's a role for an external to come in and say things that maybe an internal can't say or just not being listened to for whatever reason. But I agree with you about the skin in the game. But do you have any developments on your thinking since you wrote the book about that, Bob, about internal and external change agents?
I think I'll relate it to just if I'm building a coaching team, let's say hypothetically I'm the agile transformation, you know, poobah in a company and I'm hiring a coaching team, I would be hiring both. I would be looking for both. I would try to create a diverse. So I think there's value in having internal coaches, but I think there's value in having outside perspectives as well. I do think people tune out. I mean, John, I was an internal leader at a company, so I was coaching them, but I was also the CTO of a company. And I noticed after about 18 months or 2 years, people started tuning me out. And I was internal, and I just think there's a natural phenomenon that they get tired of listening to Bob Galen saying the same things, and having an outside voice can really help. There's just that natural, they're saying the same things, but in a different way or with a different accent or with a different graphic and it doesn't matter as long as we move forward. Exactly. So I think rotations, getting different voices, working with different teams, et cetera. Yeah. If you want to create sort of a badass agile coaching team, I think diversity matters and rotations matter and different perspectives matter. And that'll create that for you.
Yeah, you were hinting at diversity, equity, and inclusion in the book, in fairness to you. But also there's the aspect of diversity of coaching styles. If you go back to the coaching wheel, one of the things that I talk about is if you do have if you are in charge of some change or whatever, and you do want to bring in a team of people like Bob or whoever you want to bring in, do you bring in a group of people who have balance between them? So let's say you feel you're one of the stances that you're not so strong. Would you bring in, maybe that's why you pair sometimes with people who
bounce. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you can do absolutely the same with the team, right?
I think there's a misnomer in the wheel, or there's a misunderstanding or a misinterpretation that I'm encountering a lot, where people think that they have to become equally strong across all competencies in the wheel, and they get overwhelmed. And I would say no. For example, one of my favorite stories about myself is I hate to admit this, but I don't like facilitation so much. I can facilitate. I'm sort of an average facilitator. It just doesn't make me excited. I don't enjoy doing it. So I'm not going to grow that skill. Advising gets me out of bed in the morning. Transforming gets me out of bed in the morning. I get excited about that. Coaching leaders gets me excited. So those are skills that I might want to keep building, if that makes sense. Yeah, so I think depending on your role, depending on your current skills, depending on the role that you're in, depending on what you like doing, then I think you develop the wheel in different ways. And if I'm building that team, then I'm looking for complementary skills, or at least I would.
Yeah, there was a book one of my colleagues gave me years ago. It was about the corporate life cycle, Itzhak Adiza's corporate life cycle, and he used this metaphor of the dance, which you also used in the book as well. You talked about dancing with the client, but he talked about even amongst change agents that it's like a dance. Imagine a folk dance,
Yep.
and you might be leading at one point, and I might be leading another one. It's appropriate that a different person's leading it because there's a different type of thing going on that another person on the team is stronger at, and that's it's better that they lead at that moment in time. I don't mean leading
Absolutely.
in a traditional sense, but in terms of, just being at the front or the back or the sides, whatever the appropriate style is for that situation.
Well, and part of the team building, John, is finding people that have the ego management or the self-awareness to be able to. So I can say that I can dance that way, but do I really have that flexibility? And can we create that sort of nimbleness? I find a lot of coaching teams in organizations need coaches for the dynamics of the coaching team.
Yeah,
There's
absolutely.
dysfunction sometimes amongst egos run amok or arguments about, Kanban versus Scrum or whatever. I'm kidding a little bit, but when you're building that team, I think that ability to dance and to do it in a supportive fashion across team members, right, is essential.
It's magical when it happens, but it kind of brings me on to another question, Bob, about the future of agile coaching even. There's a lot of social media noise out there. The pendulum is swinging very hard. It's swinging, actually, it's swinging everywhere. It's all about cost cutting as well. So I think product people are being laid off as well, not just agile coaching folks, but there's a bit of gaslighting going on out there about, agile coaches are bad, we're all useless. There are some good ones. There are some badass ones, extraordinary badass ones. There are also a lot of average ones. But I'm curious what your feeling is in terms of the future of agility and the future of agility coaching. What way do you see the wind blowing at the moment?
So there are a lot of people weighing in, as you allude to, John. I think there's a lot of fatalist discussions going on in LinkedIn, et cetera, right now that Scrum, and it's not just coaches, Scrum Masters as well. So Scrum Masters, RTEs, agile coaches of different, dimensions, et cetera. I actually think of it, this stuff is happening. I think it's a result of there's economic pressures, but I think some of the stuff I was trying to talk about in the book, I think I one of the reasons I wrote the book is I saw the world. A friend of mine, Mark Summers, and I talk about there's a lack of professional coaching, co professionalism in agile coaching, well-roundedness in agile coaching, that really bringing, broad and deep skills. There's a lot of mediocre agile coaches who can operate maybe in professional coaching stance, et cetera. And that's not good enough. And I think, 10 years ago, we got away with that. There was euphoria around agile and we weren't challenged to bring value. Oh, they're asking questions. That's okay. Right. Bless their hearts. They must be providing some value. Now, I don't think that works. So I don't think agile coaching is going away. I think mediocre agile coaching is getting challenged. And I think excellence is going, or badassery is going to become is the competitive advantage. I think that
Indeed.
would be true from a Scrum Master's point of view. And it's not the role agile coach, but it's the skills, the breadth and depth of our skills and connecting to delivering value to the client. One of the dangers of professional coaching, when I watch someone who's in professional coaching stance, they don't get skin in the game, if that makes sense. Even though I say you're an internal coach, when they're coaching, they're not getting in the game with the team. They're sort of like a per they're surrounding the team and they're trying to influence the team from afar. It's like the team is an independent entity, and I'm just coaching from the outside. And so I think that's a mistake. And I'm just asking questions. And I'm giving the team a lot of space. And I'm like, that doesn't show much value. What if you got in the game with the team? Oh, I can't do that. Like I would argue a Scrum Master, sometimes the joke with Scrum Masters is, if the team wanted coffee, am I supposed to, I'm not a coffee order taker. And my argument would be, of course you're not. But what if they needed that? What if they, on Tuesday, what if that showed value? What if that helped them deliver something to the bottom line of the organization? Mm. I would sweep floors if necessary to support delivery of value. I'm kidding around a little bit, but there's this lack. Professional coaching, I think, is too abstracted from the work, too abstracted from the domain, too abstracted from the perception of, oh, Bob's in the game. The team delivered something, and Bob played a part in that as a coach. Bob provided value, bottom line value. And that's one of the things I'm trying to me, part of badassery is you're balancing that act of being remote, not being pickled, but also navigating to get in the game to provide value. And how do we do that depending on our coaching role?
That's a really good tip, Bob. Maybe a bit of Darwinism is going to happen where the best will survive. But
I think so.
I'm curious, will it be the best will survive, or will it be the people who play the game will survive? Because there's another thing as well, where how serious are people about change? Because accountability about change, because in your book, you talk about coaching contracts, for example.
Right.
You know,
John, I think chops are going to matter. Experience is going to rise to the top. Yeah. I think the folks that ask 1,000 questions will not have a place. I don't think that's good enough. I think we need to bring all of our skills and competencies to bear to provide value to our clients. Part of that shtick, if you will, was using terminology. Like we speak agile terminology like it's gobbledygook. We need to stop doing that. So I think the cream rising to the top would be, we need to connect to our stakeholders' agenda, not to an agile agenda or to a, you know, sort of to a methodology agenda. That's a means to an end. What are they trying to achieve? What is their agenda? What's the value proposition? How do we help them do that? It's not about speaking about Kanban or Scrum or story points or whatever. Stop doing that. It's a facade. It's a trap that we can get into. So just cutting through that and providing value. I do think there's a Darwin moment coming. That's my view. That's my hope.
Yeah. It'll probably happen across all professionalisms, product design, development, management, all sorts, I'd imagine. So maybe it's sad for a lot of people, and I hope people find their way and so on. But we also just want to make sure that people are in this change agent type gig for the right reasons, that they really do want people, they really do want to help people to change, and they have the courage to have those conversations when needed.
Can I say it in a different way, John, real quickly?
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks were riding the Agile Coach bandwagon and looking at it as a fast track.
Yeah.
Right? I can take a 2-day certification class. I can be a Scrum Master. I can call myself an Agile Coach, and it's an easy ride. Anyone who's listening to this, you don't have to be intimidated by it. You just have to work. Work. John was talking about it earlier. He went into a team and he didn't understand the domain. So he has a choice. I'm kidding. He could ask 100 questions and not be perceived to have value whatsoever, or he can do some hard work and to get into that domain and get some skin in the game and add value to that team, leveraging his experience. And that just means that you can't instantaneously become an enterprise agile coach in 5 days. You may have to work a little bit. You may want to pair with people. You may want to pair with John, like not for a day, but for a week or for a month. And you got to work your butt off. It's a worthwhile endeavor, but we can no longer like mail it in, or just, we can no longer talk a good game. We have to deliver a good game, I think.
And we need to be forever curious. I can see your bookshelf there. You know, I've got a couple of libraries here as well. Another one in the garage. We're even thinking, will we sell off some of these books, you know, at some point? You know, the ones we're not going to look at anymore. But you have to be really curious. And it's not just about doing these little courses and you're done. We really need people who are in this type of, I don't want to say a role, but this type of gig, if you like, who really want to help people to change. And
absolutely.
Thank you so much, Bob, for writing this book. It's a wonderful book and people should read it. I think you're right. It was the right time to write another book on this topic. So I'm glad you did that. And you were the first to get there with the product owner one, and you came in at the right time with the coaching, and I wish you all the best.
Can I make one final point about the book? Just one. So leaders, anyone. So the book is not just for agile coaches. So don't look at it that way. And the book is not just for Scrum. The book is for anyone. Leaders, are you listening to me? Leaders of any ilk to acquire coaching skills, and it will make you a better whatever you are. So I would argue that if you're a product owner, coaching skills will make you better. If you're a Scrum Master, they will make you better. If you're a coach, please refine your skills. They will make you better. If you're a leader of any organization, it will make you better. So be curious about becoming not a agile coach or a coach, but acquiring coaching skills. That's what the book is for.
Indeed, because if you're a top manager, you need to be in the change agent game, right? So
absolutely.
One path to it. I totally agree. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Bob. Delighted to see you here, and keep up the good work. Loving.
I was jazzed that you invited me, John. So thank you so very much.
Thank you too.